The Tom Woods Show, episode 2131.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I am so delighted to be joined once again by our old friend Alex Epstein of the Center for Industrial Progress, because today is the release day of his brand new book, and I'm telling you, this book is an absolute blockbuster. It's called Fossil Future: Why Global Human Flourishing Requires More Oil, Coal, and Natural Gas, Not Less. How about that? Alex, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Always great to be here.
All right, look, this thing is a blankety-blank masterpiece, this Fossil Future. I mean, if I wrote a book like this, as thorough and convincing and that absolutely demolishes something that every respectable, right-thinking person thinks we all know, I would feel like I could legitimately retire and feel like I'd had a successful life. I don't say that, but I interview a lot of great authors, I've written a lot of great books. But this thing is an astonishing piece of work. And if people listening to this can find themselves just to our conversation today, well, that's better than nothing, but it would be a terrible tragedy. I mean, you honestly need to have this thing.
Well, I'm a little bit lost for words, but that's amazing. I mean, I'm so glad you think that. And just to put it in perspective, I spent 6 months on the moral case for fossil fuels when I knew 1/10 as much about energy. And I spent 3 years on this one. And it's because I thought it was possible to create something like what this eventually ended up as, but it was very difficult to get it there.
Now, that is an unusual thing. We were saying just before we started here that you would take a project that you're known for, the moral case for fossil fuels. First, it has a fantastic title.
I know.
Because the title alone is a punch in the face. And so many people were influenced by it and enjoyed it. And then you took this project on again in this book. So it does lead to the question, why would you do that?
I mean, the thing is, it's for me, I have very kind of entrepreneurial bent, and I think of writing as a product. And I think of the moral case for fossil fuels as it was my most successful product in the sense of it persuaded a lot of people as well as empowered a lot of allies on this issue of what should we do about fossil fuels, which are our main source of energy and also have these impacts that concern people, especially their impacts on climate. And I was just looking at the world. And the thing is, that book had a lot of influence. It was a success for me personally. But the global discussion and policy was still going in a really, really bad direction. And I was thinking about, like, okay, what can I possibly do? And I looked at everything I'd ever done. And I thought, well, you know what? I wrote that book in 6 months. I've learned so much since then about the issues, about how to think about them, and in particular, how to persuade people about them. And so I think the best thing I could do to give me a chance at really changing this global debate much more is just to totally redo the thing and just write a total replacement. And in particular, one that's very focused on the future, hence the title Fossil Future, because what we're really facing is a movement that says we need to eliminate fossil fuels in the near future. And I wanted to look at the issue and I expected to conclude, and I did conclude, that we still need more fossil fuels for decades and even generations to come. So it was, yeah, I just thought I could do a much, much, much more effective thing. And this was the best way that I could think of how. And I'm very happy in a sense that it's coming out at a moment where I think people are more open than ever to this because they've seen that the anti-fossil fuel establishment has caused an energy crisis.
Right. And I think also right now you have a lot of people who, having had their lives thrown into turmoil for 2 years by so-called experts, are more willing to listen to dissident voices on a whole range of subjects now, because now they feel like they were suckered by these people for long enough. And now, I don't know, maybe I have to rethink a lot of things. Maybe what I'm being told about fossil fuels isn't the full story. So you have, in a sense, a ready audience. Now, you take a perspective in here that, of course, is very much embedded in your previous book, of looking at this question through the lens of human flourishing. And what is bizarre to me is that that is considered an unusual perspective from which to look at this. Human flourishing is my standard. And yet, I think most people support human flourishing. After a while, do you wonder if this is not just a matter of they've made some mistakes and they've made some intellectual errors, people who disagree with you, but could it really be that something other than human flourishing is their standard? And if so, what is it?
Definitely. It's a great question. I try to tackle this in chapter 3 of Fossil Future, which is once you can show that in practice, that what I show in chapters 1 and 2 is basically that what I call our designated experts, the people that we're trusting to speak for the experts and to help us evaluate what to do about fossil fuels, that there's this systemic problem of they ignore the enormous benefits of fossil fuels. And then they also, what I call, catastrophize the side effects. So you have this 50-year history of our designated experts saying fossil fuels are going to destroy the world. And then fossil fuels turn out to make the world much, much better, including we turn out to be safer from climate. We have less pollution, cleaner environment, more resources. So everything they say is 180 degrees wrong. And there's this question of how is that possible? And one of the explanations I offer is, well, they're not operating on the goal you might think they are. You might think, yeah, everyone is for human life, human flourishing. But in practice, I don't think they are. I think they have this belief, the leaders have this belief, and I think many of us to a smaller extent have this belief that human impact on nature is evil and that our goal should be to eliminate it. And that's a position that's very opposed to human flourishing because human beings survive and flourish by impacting nature. And then part of what I argue is that there are certain people who know that this position is anti-human and that they're not operating on a human flourishing standard. But then there are many people who get duped into it. And the quick reasons are, one is they're taught that the earth is this delicate nurturer. And so if we impact it, it's going to harm us. And so it seems like, oh, I care about human flourishing. I just don't want to impact the earth, not because we're bad, but because it's going to be great for us to not impact the earth. We'll have a safe climate. And this is just total nonsense, right? If you don't impact the earth, life is terrible for almost everyone. And then the other thing is they use these very vague terms like, I want to protect the environment. I want to save the planet. And you kind of think, oh, they want that. That means make the earth good for humans. But in practice, it really means protect the rest of nature from humans. So I do think that, yeah, in practice, almost nobody consistently thinks about this issue from a human flourishing perspective. And then there are worse motives and more innocent motives for that.
I was just watching an interview with a guy I'm sure you know, Saifedean Ammous. He likes you very much. And somebody asked him about something that I guess the governor of Washington State recently said, that by 2030, there won't be any gasoline-powered cars in Washington State. 2030. Now, they used to predict things in 2030 or call for policies to be implemented by 2030 back in like 1990 or 2000. Uh-huh. It's 2022. And he's saying that 8 years from now, there won't, and you do hear more and more of this, sometimes 2050, but sometimes 2030. There won't be any more gas-powered cars. We'll be doing this or that with our carbon footprint by then or whatever. And meanwhile, at the same time they're saying these things, you have a book called Fossil Future. So there's got to be a collision here at some point. And if what they're advocating is so damaging to human life and to things we cherish on this earth, they have to fail, that has to crash at some point. But yet everybody who is an opinion molder, let's say, or the influential opinion molders, they all agree with this stuff. And yet you're right. I mean, how do you envision, you have to, if you write a book called Fossil Future, you have to predict the future a little bit. Eventually, how does this turn out? Do they just fail and we laugh at them and fossil fuels come back or what?
Well, it's funny because this argument has more opportunity. I was optimistic in writing it, that's why I wrote it. But there's more opportunity right now because the collision you've mentioned is happening, and it's happening by an energy crisis. And so, you know, we experienced this somewhat in the US through higher gasoline prices. And even that is really outraging people. But you compare that to what's happening in Europe, where they are terrified, you know, of doing anything against Putin. Their whole position is that they are totally dependent on Russia. I mean, Russia can kill a lot of people just by cutting off natural gas. And it's pretty obvious that Europe has been one of the leaders in being anti-fossil fuel. And they have done nothing compared to these ideas of the Green New Deal, net zero. They're nowhere near that. And already we're seeing these massive problems. We're also starting to see electricity shortages, blackouts, where I am in California, you're seeing it in Texas. I think people are realizing, wait a second, this didn't used to happen when we didn't have this anti-fossil fuel movement. Maybe there's something wrong. And there's an analogy, you know, something I know you're interested in with inflation, which is that we haven't had a lot of inflation since the early 80s, and it didn't seem like a real thing to people. So when we had these inflationary policies, it seemed like, oh, well, inflation is a thing of the past. You know, I read in modern monetary theory, this can't happen, blah, blah, blah. This is all really good. And it didn't seem real because it wasn't recent. The negative wasn't recent. And the same thing was true in energy. We hadn't had a real energy crisis. And now we have an inflation crisis and an energy crisis. And it is very real to people that these policies are as bad as we say, and that we really need to rethink our policies. Otherwise, we're going to be in big trouble.
One of the things that most annoys me is ingratitude, both on a personal level, but also on a larger scale. For example, we have people who spend all day criticizing quote-unquote capitalism, and yet they live the most comfortable lives imaginable because, precisely because of the very system they spend their days condemning. In fact, Joseph Schumpeter famously argued that part of the reason we have so much criticism of capitalism is that we have a society wealthy enough to support a group of do-nothing intellectuals who sit around and complain about the very system that keeps them alive, you know? So obviously you'll see the parallel that I'm driving at here. The same thing goes for fossil fuels. The loudest of the critics are telling us all day long about how we need to get away from fossil fuels. But as you point out, and I think maybe this in some ways is the most it's hard to say which is the best chapter, but chapter 4 of your book, called Our Unnaturally Livable Fossil-Fueled World, reminds us that we ought to be grateful for whatever the side effects may be of fossil fuels. They are swamped by the overwhelming benefits to our lives, and there is no appreciation of this.
Yeah, I know. And I have a similar feeling. I mean, I've always loved, just in terms of the ingratitude, I mean, I've always loved human achievement in particular, and I've always disliked it when people don't appreciate human achievements. Because you know anything about history, you know, before these achievements, life wasn't very good. And I the example I think of a lot is flying. Like I'll sometimes wear my I Love Fossil Fuels shirt on the plane. And what I think of sometimes is, you know, someone would be comfortable wearing an I Hate Fossil Fuels shirt on the plane. But to me, that's exactly like wearing an I Hate Pilots shirt on the plane. Like if you wore an I Hate Pilots shirt, what would the pilot do? He should kick you off the plane, or at least say something really negative, because he's making it possible. But the fossil fuel industry makes it possible for the miracle of flight, among many other miracles I talk about in Fossil Future. But think about it. We can fly. And what we did is we said, hey, you know what? All of us, we would really like to fly. Who can come up with a fuel on a global scale that can allow us to fly through the air like a bird? And guess how many industries raised their hand? One, the oil industry. They said, we can do this. And we said, great, let's do it. And then we said, oh, by the way, we hate you and you're evil for making us fly. So that's just one example that I think about a lot of the broader ingratitude of having this miraculous life that's made possible by this very unique industry. That's the only industry that provides energy that's low cost, reliable, versatile, every type of machine on a scale of billions of people in thousands of places. So I'm totally with you. We need a total reorientation toward the fuels, but also toward the people who produce them.
And yet what's odd is that the people who produce them themselves very often seem apologetic, like they want to appease these people, or if I say the right thing about the wickedness of my industry, maybe that will buy me 5 more years or something. You don't really see a Howard Roark figure. You know, you don't see somebody who just proudly says, this is what I do, and it's great for me, but it's great for mankind, and it's great for you, and forget about getting any apologies from me. You know, wouldn't you? I would love to see an Ayn Randian kind of character emerge from this industry.
So I would too. And I wrote about this in Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. And the good news is that it has started to happen. So one example that was fairly prominent was that the North Face has this anti-fossil fuel stance. And one of their customers, a guy named Adam Anderson, who's the CEO of an oil field services company, he tried to get some jackets, I think, from them with his company's logo. And they said, no, we don't do this, basically. Like, we don't do fossil fuel companies. And by the way, these jackets are made of oil and natural gas, right?
I mean, saw the video he made. I know who you're talking about.
Oh, there's another guy actually who made a follow-up video who's also in the industry named Chris Wright, who's another
guy. Oh, that's the one. I was thinking of Chris Wright,
yep. But yeah, they both did these great things. But Adam wrote this letter, and it was really straight out of the Moral Case for Fossil Fuels because he had read it and been very influenced by it. And he really, really gets it. I mean, he's like the CEO is most aligned with me intellectually in terms of getting my arguments and agreeing with them and using them. And what was so cool is he did this. It got a lot of attention. And the North Face had nothing to say. It wasn't this thing that people imagine, which is, oh my God, they're going to come down on you with all these amazing scientific arguments and moral superiority. They just totally evaded the issue. And to my knowledge, they still haven't responded. And what it shows is when you really reframe this issue around looking at the full context, looking at this issue from a human flourishing perspective, and talking about the full benefits of fossil fuels in addition to side effects, the other side has nothing to say.
It's unavoidable that in talking about this, you have to talk about alternatives. And you must be sick to death talking about solar and wind.
Right? I'm not sick.
All right, good. I would hope not.
And I have a new argument that I'm really excited about talking about.
Oh, try it out on us. Let's hear.
Well, it's mostly in... So this is, here's the thing. People should read Fossil Future, but this is the one argument I've come up with since Fossil Future that is not fully in Fossil Future. So when I revise it, this will be added. So hear about alternatives. I think people are more and more seeing there's a problem in practice because the places that use solar and wind most are having all sorts of problems in terms of cost and reliability. But you'll hear these studies sometimes where it's like, this academic proved that the whole world can run on solar and wind by 2050. And this is a kind of thing where it seems intimidating to people. So for example, I debated this guy, Andrew Dessler, a climate scientist who somehow won't debate any kind of climate catastrophe stuff, but has become an alleged expert in energy economics. And he debated me. And his one point that had any compelling nature to people was, oh, well, there are all these academic studies that show that we can do this. And that supposedly refuted all of my real world evidence about what has happened and what is happening. And so I thought about what's an efficient way to refute these alleged studies. And I think I came up with something that's very much based on Austrian economics. And it's basically that all of these studies that claim to be able to rapidly replace fossil fuels with solar and wind have three things in common that they are claiming are low cost, but that we know are of indeterminate high cost. So one is they involve things that have never been done before. So including things like hydrogen planes, which don't exist on the market, or these schemes of interconnecting solar and wind and batteries on a global scale, which have never been done. So you know, when you're doing something that's never been done and not tested at all, it has an indeterminate but high cost. Then the next thing that's even more obvious is that they involve unprecedented amounts of development in the form of mining and infrastructure building. Because solar and wind are dilute, they require much more in the way of materials, much more in the way of transmission lines, et cetera. So you've got an unprecedented amount of that on a crash program, right? It's a crash program on a rapid timetable. So what happens when you do something unprecedented in terms of volume on a rapid timetable? You know the costs go up. And then the third thing, which is the kicker, is all of this is taking place in an anti-development environment. So you have this unprecedented development in nature and scope on a crash timetable in an anti-development environment. And then some academic claims it's going to be cheap, whereas there is no way of knowing how much it'll cost. But you know all three of these things will increase cost. And so you know, sight unseen, these plans are all total crackpot. So it's like this is an example of the kind of central/government planning fallacy. But I like just the specificity of what's going wrong in all of these claims where they'll say like, oh, of course, we're going to produce 10 times more batteries or 1,000 times more batteries, but they'll be cheaper than today and it's going to happen in 20 years. And you're like, no, that's definitely not how the world works. You can't just take today's price, assume that it's going to be lower on a scale of 1,000 times on a crash timetable.
All right. Well, I love these conversations with you, honestly. I want to, because you mentioned academic studies, I wasn't sure I was going to ask you, but early on in your book, you say, I understand why coming into a book like this, you might be inclined not to give me the benefit of the doubt because there is this widespread expert consensus about the need to eliminate fossil fuels. And so you might be inclined to think, well, maybe there's at least something to that. And now I want to explain to you why you should think differently. Has your experience in writing about climate, writing about energy, writing about fossil fuels, has it changed the way you look at academia? And if so, what do you think is going on? What is the fundamental problem with academia that we get all these worthless studies and we have crazy people teaching nonsensical things, easily refuted, can't debate their way out of a paper bag, and yet we're taught to look up to these people in our society? What's really going on? I mean, is this just a matter of a little bit of reform should fix the problem, or is there just something sick going on here? I mean, why is it that somebody like you, you know, you get this book published by a very, very good mainstream publisher, Penguin Random House, But for you to get much of what you're saying published in these academic journals would be almost an impossibility. And yet, you're right and they're wrong. So what do you make of this? Is this just a widespread error or is there corruption? What do you think it is?
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. And I would encourage people, I think you can just read this for free online. There's a discussion in chapter one of what I call the knowledge system, which I think is a really helpful concept for understanding what does it mean when we're told the experts say X? Where does that come from? And it doesn't come from directly getting the knowledge from all the expert researchers. There's a whole set of stages that can very much distort what researchers think, if researchers happen to be right, and they can also be wrong. But I'll talk about academia specifically here. And I think it is really, really important that we have an intellectual monopoly establishment in academia. And this is very related. I mean, to say the least, it's completely related and determined by the fact that we have government control of education and including so-called higher education. People think when they hear about, oh, government's going to give everyone school, they just think of this as this open-ended positive. But as somebody who believes in freedom to think about things, I am terrified of government-controlled education because it means the government gets to decide what is a valid idea and what is an invalid idea. And that means ultimately politicians get to decide that. So they decide that at every level of school. And then they decide that in academia, including research academia. So one story that came up in the book that really affected me, that's why I shared it, was Freeman Dyson. So Freeman Dyson is a legendary physicist, colleague of Einstein. And when the government was starting to, along with academic institutions, because they always go together, was starting to study the effects of CO2 on climate, and they were trying to model it, Dyson said, well, you have to make sure to look at the effects on plants, because he thought, well, those are more well-known, they could easily be bigger, and they're clearly very significant. If you add a whole bunch of CO2 to the atmosphere, that's plant food, that's going to have a lot of positive effects on plants that humans use, as well as the broader biosphere. There's going to be more life on Earth, all things being equal. And the point he made is that they just totally ignored that. And this is Freeman Dyson. What if Freeman Dyson can't influence this? How can Alex Epstein? But you think about what's the government's motive in most climate research? It's to have a justification for massive new government interventions in the economy. And that's what's happened. So even if all the academics are totally honest, which unfortunately is definitely not true, just the fact that the government's goal is to find something wrong with fossil fuels to justify more intervention, and that's clearly a lot of people's desire, particularly people who are lifelong statists, that totally distorts all of research. So this is the wild thing. Just these political agendas, when the government has an intellectual monopoly, can distort all of research and all of science. And it's not a conspiracy in the sense of behind the scenes. It's right out in the open.
And so this is why, for in so many cases, that we need to look to independent scholars like yourself to get the full truth. I mean, we could say the same thing about a number of fields. For a long time, we were told, don't eat eggs. Don't eat eggs? What kind of an idiotic thing is that to say? But that was the mainstream view. And only the occasional crackpot would tell you, actually, eggs do a lot of good for you, you know, and now it's, oh yeah, maybe we should have been eating eggs. So at this point, I used to, I think at one point in my life, I probably did defer to the quote unquote experts because I thought, well, you know, they have a, in an ideal world, if there's a group that has a large body of specialized knowledge, then I would defer to them. And in some cases, like some, the guy who makes, you know, builds my car, I don't know how my car works, I defer to them. But my gosh, as I say, after we've lived through 2 years of deferring to people because they have degrees, and I see what destructive totalitarian nonsense comes out of them, I don't know how much longer I can do that. Probably not.
Well, now, let's talk about just very quickly on the COVID thing, because you and I were both very passionate about this, and you were nice enough to have me on your show a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
I really wanted to get on the record about how to think about that issue, and I think I was vindicated about how to think about it. So the issue you raised is so important because we absolutely need specialized / expert knowledge to function as individuals and as society. And yet we know that what we're told the experts say can be totally 180 degrees wrong. So in Fossil Future, I give a bunch of guidelines how to think about this. But one in particular that really came up with COVID is anytime you are told the experts or the scientists say that a given course of action / policy is mandated, you know you are being duped, because the policy is always going to be determined by a wide variety of factors, never just one narrow domain. So it's never just climate science, say in energy, or just virology or just COVID in the case of COVID, because there are all these other diseases and all these other considerations, which is part of what we were talking about the whole time. You can't just look at this one thing. So whenever, if you just have a single specialist tell you what to do about a policy issue that involves multiple factors, that's a fraud. But also there are always these issues of values. Anytime you're talking about action, you're talking about values. And with energy, there's this real issue of, is your goal to advance human flourishing on Earth, which is my goal, or is your goal to eliminate human impact on Earth? Those are different goals. And with COVID, you could say, is your goal to, in general, advance human flourishing, you know, advance health in this context, or is it to stamp out one particular virus? And the operating goal for most of COVID policy was stamp out one particular virus. And that is not a justifiable goal. It's certainly not an obvious goal. And yet that was taken as the obvious goal because the prestige of the researchers was misapplied to that very controversial goal. So anytime somebody says the scientists say do X, you know you are being defrauded.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute for me to give you some very, very valuable advice. This is advice that is going to score you a lot of points with your spouse or a significant other. It doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman. That person you love is going to be so impressed by your creativity and thoughtfulness. And you don't even have to say, I got the idea from Woods. I'm just giving this to you. You can run with it. You can act like it was your idea. That's fine. Whatever promotes happiness and happy relationships in the world is fine with me. And of course, what I'm talking about is the wonderful Happily Date Box, which I've been receiving for nearly 3 years now. Every month you get an amazing box filled with interesting, fun activities that you can do with your significant other. It's a way to have a date night in. You'll get a music playlist, maybe a little project to work on, games to play, questions that provoke deep and meaningful conversations, intimate moments that bring the two of you together. They're just wonderful. You're just going to love them. And when you say, hey, I subscribed us to this Happily Date Box service, you're just going to be looked at with a loving gaze. You're going to have that loving gaze into your eyes like, ah, I knew I was right choosing you. Okay? You want to get that gaze? You can get that at tomwoods.com/date. Not to mention, if you go to tomwoods.com/date, you get 50% off your first date. So what possible reason would you have? What, do you not like having a loving gaze in your eyes? Come on. So head over to tomwoods.com/date, get 50% off your first date, enjoy time together, and you are welcome. Let's jump ahead, if we may, because there's just no getting around. You have to say something about the issue of climate change. But what I like is your chapter 9 about the full context of this, because especially lately, there's been a lot of catastrophic warning. And incidentally, I very rarely do I see them say, although I have seen a couple of these, but very rarely do I see them say, it's too late, there's nothing we can do about it, catastrophe is baked into the cake. It's always never too late. There's still time to act. There's been time to act for the last 10, 20, 30 years. I'm waiting for them to be honest enough and say to me one day, all right, look, that's it. You stupid rubes won. There's going to be catastrophe as far as the eye can see. So we do see a lot of catastrophizing about what might happen. And we also get told about all the individual bad things that could happen. But it does seem to me that given that temperatures have been variable over the centuries and millennia, that a somewhat modest change in the temperature should have pros and cons. I don't understand what would be all cons.
Me neither.
So how do you address this?
This is actually one of the things that my thinking evolved on quite a bit, because in Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, I had some of, hey, there's this fertilizer effect, which means the greening that comes from more CO2. But I don't know if I talked at all. If I did, I talked very little just about the benefits of warming. And I realized that's because I still had some of this bias against human impact that pervades our society. And so I had some element of, well, if we cause the warming, it must be bad, or mostly bad or overwhelmingly bad. And yet, if you look at the situation, what we know is that cold-related deaths far, far exceed heat-related deaths. That's one thing. We know that, you know, in the different models and in practice, cold regions of the Earth, when it's warming, warm more than warm regions. So it's not the equator gets super hot. It's more that the polar regions get less cold. And so just that alone And also given that people tend to want to live in warmer areas, we're a tropical species, what global warming slash climate change really mean is that the Earth becomes more tropical at some rate. And why are we assuming that's all bad? So the fact that this is just a giveaway, that there is this anti-human slash anti-human impact bias in the world, that we just assume that if we cause warming, it must be bad. And if you look at the numbers, it's particularly crazy because they talk about 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees as these terror numbers, but that's starting from the 1800s. So we're already at 1 or 1.1 degree. So what they're saying is another half a degree or degree of warming is going to make the world this terrible place uniformly, even though the world is an amazing place, including, as I like to stress, we are 50 times safer from climate-related disasters. So 50 times fewer people die from climate-related disaster deaths than did 100 years ago. So one other perspective is if people deny the present, they can't be trusted to predict the future. So the people who act like today's world is terrible and we're super endangered from climate, that is factually false from a human flourishing perspective. So we obviously, if they think today's world is bad climate-wise, nothing they say about the future can be trusted.
Indeed. So I'm going to give you a little challenge here. Let's imagine that you are, in fact, in a debate, and the debate is centered around a resolution involving the desirability of phasing out the use of fossil fuels, and you get a 1-minute opening statement. Mm-hmm. What would that look like? What do you try to hit? How do you get people to change the way they look at this, the lens they're using, in just a little time?
I would just say, for people listening, check out energytalkingpoints.com because I have a lot of stuff there, including fossil fuels. But I think the key things to get are that low-cost, reliable energy is crucial to human life because that's what enables us to be productive and prosperous, and otherwise life is pretty terrible. And then the fact is that the world desperately lacks energy. We have 3 billion people who are using less electricity than one of our refrigerators. If we look at how people can get that energy, we see that fossil fuels, after 100 years of competition, are 80% of the world's energy and growing fast, particularly in the poorest parts of the world that most value low-cost, reliable energy. So you at least have to acknowledge that fossil fuels have incredible benefits going forward and that it could very easily be tragic if we lost them. And then on top of that, you have to recognize that fossil fuels, one thing they do that we don't recognize is they make us far safer from climate because they enable us to do things like heat when it's cold, cool when it's hot, alleviate drought, et cetera. And that climate mastery has brought down climate-related disaster deaths by 98% or 50x over the last 100 years. So I would just try to get at, there are these amazing benefits of fossil fuels, including climate benefits, that nobody is talking about. And the fact that nobody is talking about that should make you question whether they're thinking about it the right way.
All right, that's very good. And then on the other side of things, maybe painting a picture for people of what life would be like if the anti-fossil fuel crusaders got their way might be effective. Because Patrick Moore, you know him, mm-hmm. formerly of Greenpeace, paints a very, very grim picture of what this would mean for human life. I mean, it's astonishing to me that AOC and other people can talk about the Green New Deal as if it's this extraordinarily wonderful thing. But if implemented, it would lead to extraordinary human suffering and impoverishment.
I mean, I think it's hard to imagine life going backwards. But I think, you know, the best example we have in recent times is Venezuela, which is a relatively prosperous Latin American country. I don't think anyone could have imagined the kind of degradation that occurred, and that's anti-freedom, but part of anti-freedom is anti-fossil fuels. So you see what happens when you don't have a properly functioning grid, when fuel is hard to access. I mean, you have something like the average person losing 25 pounds involuntarily. Like, it's literally possible to starve. And maybe the best example is agriculture, because we have an unnaturally abundant world, a nourishing world in terms of food. We have 8 billion people being fed by a planet that's historically feeding 500 million or a billion people. And that's only because of fossil fueled machines and because of fossil fuel derived fertilizer, specifically from natural gas. And this is 8 billion people's lives hang in the balance of us being able to have enough low-cost energy to fuel all those agricultural machines and to derive that fertilizer. And this is why you're starting to have the president of the United States and other people talk about starvation. We're already having this happen. So I'd say we're already regressing There was the Great Reset, which is really the Great Regress. Like, this is already happening here and in other countries. And, you know, Venezuela provides an example, and it is not a place we want to go. And that's even doing this partially. If we did it fully, you would just have billions of people die prematurely. There's no question in my mind.
That's unbelievable. I mean, honestly,
It's for sure. So the one point I try to make, and this is part of my motivation, and I talk about it in chapter 11, is I don't think the whole world is going to pursue net zero. I mean, we look at China, right? They're expanding fossil fuel use. Does anyone think Russia is going off fossil fuels? They're actually the most honest about, no, we are not doing that remotely. We're doubling down on fossil fuels. Is India going to get off fossil fuels? Which, that's a much better place than those other two places. But no, of course not. So it's not that the whole world is going to go net zero, but the point is, to whatever extent you make energy more expensive and less reliable, and we're considering doing that to a drastic extent, you make yourself poor. And in the case of the United States and other free countries, you drastically endanger your security. Because what we don't want is the free world unilaterally disempowering, that is, making ourselves less able to produce energy, while the less free parts of the world get more energy and more control. And that's exactly what's happening. So one of my big motivations was stop the US in particular from this unilateral disempowerment that is going to drastically harm our economy, our standard of living, and our security. And that's, to me, that's the most existential part of it, particularly for me as an individual. Just the idea of China achieving its goal of world dominance by 2049, that is not a world I want to live in, or I want my kids to live in.
Let me ask you one more thing. During the height of COVID craziness, or even really now, you would get sometimes really benign material taken down from YouTube that were completely defensible statements, and that later on everyone would eventually come to acknowledge. And I wonder if now that that seems to be subsiding, and I know that we've seen in the media, they've said that once that goes, we're going to turn to climate change and really, really, really hit that hard. If this kind of censorship stuff, I mean, I know technically it's not state censorship, but it's annoying. If that's going to become increasingly transferred to people who dissent on energy policy like you, have you already run into anything like that?
Yes. So I'll give my strategy for dealing with this. And this is not, so I call it suppression that happens by these platforms. And the thing I've most experienced is LinkedIn, interestingly. So LinkedIn has taken down, I think, 3 of my posts. Now, interestingly, in every case, I've gotten them to recant and apologize for doing it. But that's because I have a big public platform and I'm very, very savvy about the exact facts that I post. So I don't post things that can be manipulated in a certain way. And in particular, so basically, if you want to get canceled or deplatformed, the way to do it is you say something that's close to a purely scientific statement that contradicts a government official scientific statement on an issue that it considers urgent. So COVID would be the number one, but also climate. So I don't do that. What I do is I always make evaluations. I mean, I'll give certain facts about the kind of economics of climate, about climate-related disaster deaths, but I don't say things like, oh, the consensus is total bullshit, the IPCC is totally wrong on science, and this would be something I don't believe, but like the sun is the only thing warming the earth, right? If you say those kinds of things, given these current content policies, you will be deplatformed. So I don't say those things. In part, I don't believe a lot of the things that get people deplatformed, but I also know that their policy, whether they state it or not, is if you contradict just on scientific grounds, the direct government urgent scientific statement, that's what they care about. And at least so far, they don't care about the other things. Now, Elon Musk, whom I have very mixed feelings about for many reasons, he's talking about, I want to make Twitter freer. But then the other day he said, well, this is pretty much an exact quote. He said, well, like, I don't want things that are illegal or bad for the world. Now, this is a guy who's blocked me on Twitter for saying that the Tesla is a good fossil fuel powered car. So the idea of bad for the world as a standard is quite ominous in my view.
And of course, and who gets to decide that? Him?
Right. So I think he's probably, I just think he hasn't actually, it's very complicated to think about how to do content moderation and policy on a platform. And I don't think he's thought all of this stuff through. So I don't think he would actually settle on that. But this is just the one more perspective. What I said before is anytime people tell you that the experts have determined some course of action to be some scientific absolute, you know, you're being defrauded. And it's part of why these platforms should not be in the business of dictating what ideas are right. I mean, ideas are really thoughts about what actions we should take as individuals and societies. And that's the kind of thing that has to be totally open to debate. Because even if you're totally right about one scientific issue, which is hard enough to do, that doesn't determine what the right idea is about the issue.
All I can tell people at this point is just to go out and get your book. Okay, because I'd love to do a Joe Rogan style interview. But then on the other hand, they listen to your interview on Joe Rogan. They think, I pretty much read the book. No, no, you have not. Doggone it. You've got to go out and read it. Fossil Future is the book we've been talking about. Why Global Human Flourishing Requires More Oil, Coal, and Natural Gas, Not Less, by our guest, Alex Epstein. Well, I'm so glad to have a chance to at least skim the surface of this book with you on the release date today. And I hope it's a big success for you in every way, not just as a personal accomplishment, but also in influencing minds and changing the conversation out there. So thanks, Alex.
Thanks so much, Tom. And just if people want to get, you know, some cool resources along with the book, just make sure to go to fossilfuture.com and you can learn all about it there.
Oh, okay. I'll link to that on our show notes page, fossilfuture.com. Got it. Okay. Thanks again.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for today. Tomorrow, John Mueller of The Ohio State University joins us to discuss his book, The Stupidity of War. We're going to review more than a half century of U.S. interventions and then look to the future with what we've learned from those interventions. So it's going to be a great, great episode. So hope you like what you hear here on The Tom Woods Show. And if you do, join me as a supporter at supportinglisteners.com and wait till you see all the goodies you get. You're going to say, why did I wait so long to treat myself to these goodies? Well, better late than never. So head over to supportinglisteners.com and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.